My name is Gary Borenson, and I am talking today on the title, New Ways of Seeing. It's kind of interesting maybe to you that I gave a similar talk when I was at Poland 5 years ago. My wife and I were here on a winter program at that point, and I was just at that time putting together some ideas on this topic, and since then, a number of books have been written in the same area. A lot more writing has been done, and I've seen what a vital, active area of research and concern it is amongst a number of people. And so I figured it was very appropriate to do an update on that kind of a talk that I gave in 1979. Call this New Ways of Seeing version, the 1985 version. I teach at Western Washington University in Bellingham, but another thing, that's only a part-time position, and another thing that I do is to work with the American Lutheran Church, ELC, in the Mission Discovery Program. Mission Discovery is a group of about 25 or 30 people around the country that, they call themselves Discovery Probers. They probe different areas of interest or activity in the church, sometimes areas that are kind of marginal to the everyday concerns of congregations, but that when you look at the church nationwide, come to be very important issues that the church needs to be aware of and deal with. The report I'm giving today, or the talk I'm giving today, the subject I'm bringing up, is closely tied in with some work I've been doing with the ALC. The past several years, and it culminated in a paper that I wrote for them in 1984, which I have some copies of if you'd like to see it later, but my talk today is going to be largely based on that, although I'm going to be extending some things that I've seen dawn off since then as well. If any of you besides Janice were here last night, you might hear some of the themes that I referred to last night coming out in today's presentation as well. Basically, it's becoming clear to a lot of people that something big is happening in the world, in our culture, in our civilization. And while some people have an attitude toward history that says there's really nothing new under the sun, everything that we see nowadays is always has happened before. Nothing really new is going on. There's no real change. Sure, there's this fad and that fad, but nothing really new is happening. That point of view is being contradicted by a number of writers and a number of thinkers and a number of futurists who look at the world and say, we're going through a period of really radical transformation right now. We're kind of just entering into it, and something radical is happening. It's been compared with the Reformation. It's been compared with the Renaissance. It's been compared with the Great Awakenings in this country, spiritual revivals of earlier centuries. Some people say, no, it should. Those are small compared to what's going on now. It should be compared with the discovery of agriculture, for example, or emergence from the caves. It's that radical of a change that we might be experiencing as a civilization. Just in the past 10 years, the number of books coming out on that subject has been just incredible. I'll read some of the titles or the references to this type of transformation. One person calls it just the transformation. It's been called the turning point. You're probably familiar with the Aquarian conspiracy. The New Age, the Solar Age, the Homecoming, the Emerging Order, the Emerging Image, the Emerging Paradigm, the Emerging Consciousness, the End of Patriarchy, the Third Wave, the Great Liberation. The Great Liberation, El Gran Liberacion, coming out of Liberation Theology, seeing that God is in the process of liberating all of humanity, and that liberation is coming especially in our time, in these days. The evidence for such a transformation is not only in the writings of these social commentators, but it's also pretty apparent in the emergence of a number of social movements in our age. There have always been social movements. There's always, there were the suffragettes and there were the prohibitionists, and every era has its movements. But if you do some kind of accounting of those, it just seems as though there's a lot of movement going on in these days. And historians look back and they can kind of look in history and they've seen that prior to periods of radical social change, a lot of fermentation goes on and a lot of movements spring up. So movements are sort of seen as symptomatically as a sign that something's happening, that the old order is somehow primed for some kind of transformative process. We can name some of those movements. I've got a number in a chart that I include in this paper, but you can probably name some more of your own. But there's certainly in the peace movement, there's all different threads and directions to that. There's those advocating arms limitation, unilateral disarmament, bilateral disarmament, nuclear disarmament. There's the peace movement as a whole. There's nonviolence as a more radical form of peace movement, nonviolent movement. Then there's, feeding in some sort of a different direction altogether, the environmental concerns, the energy concerns, resources, pollution, appropriate technology movement, decentralization, voluntary simplicity, lifestyle questions. And then there's the whole justice side, the concern with human rights, concern with minority rights, concern with criminal justice, with world health, with foreign aid, with world hunger. As you get more radical into like new economic order worldwide, the feminist movement might be in that category, in the justice category, although it spreads over into the peace movement, the environmental movement as well. There's a kind of a fourth corner of this movement diagram would be all the human potential stuff. If you're from California, or if you have any California friends, that's where it really is big. But we hear about it too. There's the I'm okay, you're okay. There's the human potential. The holistic health ideas. There's nutrition, fitness, meditation, prayer. There's a lot more interest in meditation and meditative techniques. And as with East meeting West, in the joining of the Eastern traditions of worship and the Western traditions of worship, there's a lot of ferment going on right now in the attitudes toward prayer, toward meditation. New styles of evangelism. And new attitudes toward the Bible, toward biblical consciousness. There seems this is pointed to not only in our church, but a lot of it's occurring, but in fundamentalist denominations as well as in the Roman Catholic Church and in liberal Protestant churches. There's a revival of interest in the Bible and the scriptures and Bible study, and there seems to be some ferment going on there. So the interesting thing about all this is, I mean, all I'm trying to say is there's a lot of ferment, there's a lot of movement, there's something's happening. And it seems as though as you probe into or push into any one of these areas, if you get really excited about environmentalism, the deeper you go into environmentalism, the more you see that it has something to do with peace and justice and human potential. Or likewise, if you come in through criminal justice, and that's your concern is our court system and our prison systems and what causes criminality and those kinds of issues, you start coming against some of these same issues of this has something to do with violence, it has something to do with nonviolence, it has something to do with urban environments, or it has something to do with environments in general, and it has something to do with multinational corporations, and it has something to do with exploitation of the poor. And you start, no matter which direction you come in from, people, as they push on their particular concerns, go to the depths of their particular movement, very frequently find themselves coming out into a similar territory, which doesn't have a name, or at least I don't know what to name it. But there seems to be sort of a common ground, and people use that phrase certainly to refer to that a different vision of the way the world could be if somehow the sources of tension and annoyance from these different movements could be sort of fulfilled or satisfied or brought to fruition. The Christian has an analog of all that process in God's redemptive activity in the world. I think we believe, it's pretty biblical, that God's in a process of transforming things. God is bringing about a transformative process in the world. And now, I don't mean to say that the fulfillment of all these movements is going to be the kingdom of God on earth, but there's a parallel in the sense that I believe God is active. God is not just a God who allows things to be, but there is a process of redemption and healing and bringing of health to the sick structures that we have and the problems that we have. And that's a process that's going on and that I try to look for and see where it's happening. Where is God's action in the world? In the liberation movements, in the peace movements, in the human justice movements, and many other places as well. I've just really scratched the surface on the, these are sort of the more global concerns. Many people pay attention to what's going on interpersonally on the smaller scale, more local scale, and certainly God is alive and well there too, and transforming people's lives at the individual level as well. When you start trying to say what's common to all these movements, no, I'm getting ahead of me. Let's go back for a second. If you want to bring about change in any one of those areas, you, as I was sort of suggesting, you very often come to realize that you need change in all the areas. It's not just that you come to a common ground, but you also recognize that change needs to be not just incremental or specific, but needs to be comprehensive or systemic. It has to affect the whole system. That the whole system is fallen, and the whole system needs redeeming. And that recognition of interconnections among all these things, I think, is a really important aspect of a new way of seeing. It's not just that I have to change myself, it's not just that I have to change the things I'm part of, it's that the whole bag is in a process of transformation and change. Other signs of this kind of transformative process are occurring at the leading edges of research in a number of different fields. I happen to be in physics, and I see a lot of it going on there. There's a real ferment in physics these days, in mathematics and ecology, in evolution theory, in psychology, in brain theory, in consciousness theory, in linguistics. Linguistics is a fascinating field. Read about it if you're not into it. It's really wild, all the implications it has for everyday experience. In philosophy, in religion, in politics, in the arts. There was a research team at Stanford Research Institute, it's now called SRI, that did a study just a couple years back of all the various areas of academic, you know, intellectual, scientific type of endeavor, trying to see what were the questions that were being asked at these leading edges, at the frontiers. What was the nature of the questions? And then they stripped away all the jargon that's specific to each field to see what, can we see any common Oh, goodness, another.
Jet.
Is it?
There's some military jets that come through.
Oh, wow.
Flying low.
They were looking for common concerns in all these different areas, like the areas I just named. Is there anything, any pattern that you could see of change occurring at these frontiers of knowledge? And they concluded, yes, indeed there are. They identified seven categories that we'll name a little bit later, of ways of thinking that, and types of questions that seem to be arising at the leading edges of all these research areas. They call this an emergent paradigm. The word paradigm has been thrown around a lot lately, but I'm not sure how acquainted with it you all are. The word really means a pattern. It's from the Greek word paradigma, it means a pattern. And it used to be used more in the narrow sense to mean just a pattern. Any pattern could be a paradigm or an archetype, sort of. But the word, since 1962, Thomas Kuhn wrote a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And in that book, he dragged up that word paradigm and used it to refer more to a way of seeing things, a worldview, a perspective, a whole frame of reference. In other words, more like a pattern of thought, not just a pattern, but a pattern of perception. The lenses that you wear to see, through which you see, through which everything you see gets filtered. That's what the word paradigm is going to mean more. I've got more of a formal definition here. A worldview, a perception of reality, which provides a perspective for understanding, interpreting, and responding to everything that we know or experience. So it may include your beliefs, your values, your assumptions, your prejudices, your priorities, your goals, desires, your visions of the future, your language, it's all part of your paradigm, your jargon, the literature, the myths and stories, the theories, the mental models, the methodologies that you use, the practice that you use, the techniques. In short, anything which organizes and lends meaning to the perceptions and the thoughts and the communications and the actions of the people that adhere to the paradigm. Pretty big word, pretty inclusive. But it's useful. It's useful because the things we choose to do and the things we choose to say and the way we talk, the way we communicate, the way we live our lives is influenced and shaped by the paradigm that we hold. And of course, each person's paradigm is a little different, but they overlap a lot, fortunately. And insofar as they overlap, we can communicate. But that's why communication is not always perfect, because our paradigms don't always overlap very well. And sometimes our communication, especially when paradigms are only scarcely overlapping, communication becomes very, very difficult because the use of language is very different. Kuhn was making an argument, the fellow who wrote this book that used the word paradigm so much, was making an argument that said scientists, even, these archetypes of rationality, have a great deal of trouble communicating rationally when it comes to paradigm conflict. Because to settle conflicts between paradigms is not a rational process. Rationality works within a paradigm, it does not work between paradigms. Because the type of rationality you use is paradigm dependent. It depends on your assumptions, it depends on your glasses, it depends on all the baggage you bring into things. And so, he was saying, of course, communication is very difficult and impossible. But before I don't want to get too far off on that. I just want to say that if a paradigm change is occurring, or if these, like these SRI, Stanford Research Institute people say, we're looking at the frontiers of knowledge at a new type of paradigm emerging, that's a pretty radical thing to be saying. Saying there's a profound change at the very core of human existence, at the very core of our civilization, that we're coming into a transformed perception of reality, a transformed way of seeing, hence the title of this talk, that's not commensurate, that doesn't mesh up, that doesn't communicate perfectly with the prior, earlier ways of seeing. I don't think it's sacrilegious to compare with like Paul's transformation on the road to Damascus, you know, a conversion experience, when suddenly all the world looks different to him. And he's blind at first, and then from that point on, the whole world looks different. All the things he was doing in the past are interpreted in a new light, and he sees, oh my God, what have I been doing? So the images of conversion and of redemption, I think, I'm not saying the new paradigm is God's kingdom, or it's the will of God is the answer to everything, because this is being defined in a secular context, and I'm not going to pretend that it's, you know, the ultimate answer. It's highly biblical. It's not necessarily, but it is. But to use the images of conversion or of redemption, I think are appropriate for the kinds of, to appreciate the order of magnitude of the kind of thing that's happening. Okay, now, with all that, what is it? How can you characterize a new paradigm? Some of you probably, you know, have already been thinking of, in your own mind, what's he talking about? What does he mean? You know, I can see things maybe, or maybe you can see things in your own experience that might have that kind of quality about them. Maybe you've thought about all these things before, but I'm going to give you my attempt at trying to synthesize some of the writings and some of the people that have talked in this kind of paradigm language, and give you a comparison of sort of this, the old style, old paradigm, old way of seeing, and the new paradigm. And it's pretty hard to do. It's pretty arrogant to try and synthesize the writings of 100 people. And I haven't even read all these books or anything that I quoted at the beginning of the talk. But it seems still helpful to try and get a feeling. And I think that's best. The best thing to do is not to try and list or name everything, but sort of evoke a feeling for an old way of looking at things and a new way of looking at things. And it's not just that the new way is somehow better. I'm not meaning to say, okay, we've had this old way, the old way doesn't work, now we've got a new way, the new way is going to be the answer to all our problems. It's more that the old paradigm has been the only paradigm for thousands of years. It's been by far the predominant one, and the main way we look at things. And to introduce a new paradigm is to not say, aha, we have to scrap this and raise up this. It's to say, we've only been seeing part of the picture. Our eyes have been closed, and now we're going to open up and see more, and see more comprehensively. We're going to balance a new alternative against the dominant way we've been doing things in the past. The new kind of moderates the excesses of the old, balances it, makes it whole, makes it more complete. But it's not an either or. And it's not that some people are one way, some people are the other. And there's the old joke about there's two kinds of people in this world, those that divide the world into two kinds of people and those that don't. Well, I don't want to divide all thinking and all people into two kinds of people and say, okay, you're an old paradigm person, you're a new paradigm person, you're okay, you I can't relate to. Because it's not that sharp, and I find in myself a lot of conflict, recognizing when there are parts of me that do things in an old paradigm way and like it. And there are parts of me that say that want to challenge that. And I think it's good to recognize the tension and the benefit of that conflict as being growth producing. So let me try and give you a flavor, old and new. This is kind of the heart of this talk. If I had to choose a single word to characterize the new way of looking at things, and it's not all that new, you're going to hear when I tell you the word, I picked the word holism. The word's been around it's been around since the 20s. I think that's about what was coined as a word. But It wasn't even in my dictionary in 1962. I've got a dictionary I got when I graduated high school in 1962. The word's not in there, either with a H, spelled with an H, or spelled with a W. Nobody talked about holism in 1962. And somehow during the 60s and 70s, the word became elevated in our vocabulary. And just about now everything's holistic. Holistic health, and holistic medicine, and holistic this, and holistic therapies. And we must have holistic attitudes. And I mean, it's getting to be almost trite. And yet there's a lot said in that word, holism. It's part of what I mean by this, a different way of thinking. The need for a more holistic perspective and for a theory and language capable of dealing with organized wholes has recently arisen in practically every field of research and in every area of human activity. We see the amazing growth in recent decades of the fields of general systems theory, along with associated ways of thinking and perceiving, and that points to the widespread encountering of basic limitations and inadequacies of earlier approaches to analyzing. In fact, we even use the word analysis as being a way of understanding things. The word analysis means chopping things into parts, breaking things up into little bits, because you can't understand the whole, supposedly. And so the scientific method is to strip away all the externalities that you aren't interested in, focus on this little piece, and then study that little piece, and understand that little piece, and then hope that somehow you can put it back into a context and figure out how the whole works. Well, we know now, and it's cliche almost now, that the whole is not equal to the sum of the parts. The whole can be more than the sum of the parts. You can have interactive processes which make the whole somehow completely different than the parts. That there's a behavior that emerges in whole systems that is not predictable on the basis of knowing the behavior of each of the parts. Try to stop and give examples of everything. So it necessitates a methodology in research areas to deal with wholes. In government and in universities, in education, in social programs, we frequently find the bureaucratization, putting all the things that deal with this thing over in this box, and all the things that deal with this over in this box, and this in this box, and then we get specialists to administer this and this and this, with the idea that somehow things have become so complex that we need to break things into ever smaller bits in order to be able to deal with them and administer them. And we need experts that are ever more narrow in order to be able to deal with each particular topic. The opposite of that is to recognize that there are strong interactions amongst all these boxes and categories, and that a social program over here that's doing this is going to be defeating to one that's over here doing this, and that somehow you have to have people trained to recognize how they all interact, and that when you push over here, you pop up over here, you've got to do something, balance them all together and see the whole picture. That goes along with this idea of, well, there's words that apply to that. Reductionism, atomism, breaking things up into atoms, smallest bits, disjointedness, separation, an emphasis on separation and separateness, an emphasis on boundaries, on drawing lines between things, classifying, categorizing. And as I said last night, once you've classified things, there's a tendency to evaluate them, to judge them. If you've separated, then you can say, this one's better, this one's worse. This one's higher, this one's lower. This one's first, this one's last. This is left, this is right. Making dualisms, making dichotomies, splitting the world into old paradigm and new paradigm. All these dichotomies, this dichotomous thinking, is really characteristic of the old way of thinking about things. And the new way, or the new need, is to be able to deal with fuzziness and holes, to deal with connectedness and interaction, integration, and the systemic complexity that arises because of those interactions. openness, connectedness, relationship. Not the things themselves, the relationship becomes the important concern. So going along with that, paralleling that, is with this emphasis on openness over here and on boundaries over here, on internationalism over here, on nation states over here. Going along with that would be the technique, the skill that you use for working in this domain is all the left brain stuff, the reason, analysis. You use quantities and numbers, you number things, you count a lot. The emphasis is on know-how and on technique, science and knowledge. In fact, our word science means knowledge. Ciencia, it's the word for knowledge. What's over here? What do you do if you don't have science? What about intuition? What about inspiration? What about meditation? There are all kinds of routes to knowledge other than science, and yet we've exalted science as the means of knowing. I mean, the word science means knowledge, so I'm a scientist. Oh, you're one who knows. What about the all other people who know? There's all kinds of people who know in this society besides scientists. So we have insight, intuition, aesthetics on this side, enlightenment, an emphasis on know why versus know how, on purpose versus technique. On this side, objectivity and absolutism. The need over here is to define things so carefully and so precisely, and the assumption is that you can be objective about that process. Well, we just said in this whole description of paradigm that the way you see the world colors everything you do. So that means that total objectivity, the detachment, separateness, isn't really possible. Things are always interconnected, interplaying. Everything you do is participatory, and everything you see is colored by your particular paradigm, your way of seeing it. So reality then, your reality, becomes perspective dependent. And so there's a sort of a relativism that comes in on this side. Determinacy, definiteness, intrinsic indeterminacy over here. Not just that things are hard to determine, or it's difficult to determine or pin them down, they're intrinsically undeterminable. They're intrinsically fuzzy bounded. You can't draw firm lines around things, box them. The physicists really, I mean, they know this, they should know it better than anyone else. The principles of quantum mechanics that came about in the early part of this century talk about what happens when we try to reduce down to see the smallest little fundamental particles, like atoms, and then beyond that to the electrons and the protons. And pretty soon we got so far down that we ran into a problem. It's called Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. You've probably heard of it, maybe you don't understand it. I don't even quite understand it. It suggests that as you try and narrow things down and localize them and put a little box around them, they defy. Nature defies you to do that, will not allow you to do that. The thing becomes spread out no matter how hard you try to pin it down. Its identity becomes fuzzed out. It becomes non-localizable, even though you try to localize it. There's the famous wave-particle duality, that something, if you ask it to be a particle, it will be a particle. But when you're not asking it, it'll be a wave. Travels through space like a wave, and has wave-like properties that interfere with each other, and there's no particles at all until you put in an observer to say, okay, where are you? And at that point, it'll appear as a particle. And suddenly this wave that was spread out all over space, in effect, collapses and localizes its energy into one spot to tell you where it is. But then when you're not looking again, it turns back into a wave. It's bizarre. It's really bizarre. And yet it's a fascinating mental model or metaphor for the way a lot of things in life are.
You're giving kind of scientific language. Are you saying on the one hand a sort of mystery, And the other hand is, you said determinism. Mm-hmm. Can you think of some more other words that I might understand a little bit better?
Determinism.
I think I have a sense of mystery. I think I sense that it's being some of what you said, but this
right.
other side.
Good. That's good.
Tell me what that is.
Determinism would be the old sort of billiard ball notion of the way the world works. That here are the atoms, we're all a bunch of atoms, we know that, right? And everything just kind of goes about its merry way according to the laws of physics, the laws of nature. The atoms move, they interact, they combine, they bounce off each other. It's
So the lack of knowledge is simply an inability to have completed the process of discovering all the rules.
Right, right, and that's all.
Yeah.
But the ideal is that, I mean, from that point of view, the ideal is that once we know all those rules, then the world is completely determined. We can say, aha, everything that we see is explainable in terms of these ordered laws of nature.
And that's the old paradigm.
Right.
You can't explain it. The new paradigm,
so
unexplainable.
Intrinsically, you can't explain it. You'll never be able to explain it. And it's not just your ignorance. Mm-hmm. It's that's the way nature works. Mm-hmm. Einstein has this famous quote that says, he was very frustrated by this new physics. Mm-hmm. He's one of the fathers of it. He was very frustrated by it. And he said, I refuse to believe that God plays dice. He wanted God to know and shape and make and determine how the world went. And the physicists nowadays are saying, God plays dice. The laws of nature are probabilistic. They're not deterministic. Here's magic. Here's magic. Now, you know, I want to allow God to have some control over those probabilities. That's fine with me. But that's a different perspective. It's a different way of looking at what goes on in the world. Okay, let's see. I'm going to get some of these. Let's see. There's an emphasis over here on mechanical ordering of information, on hierarchy, on top-down, on bureaucracy, on linear logic and causality, assembled order, domination, control, achievement, mastery. Over here, on the other side would be, as opposed to mastery, receptivity, or part of that openness idea. Openness meaning everything is open to everything. Everything interacts. If you recognize everything interacts, everything is open, whether we acknowledge it or not. When we start drawing boundaries, those are our boundaries that we've drawn. They're arbitrary. Receptivity, participation. Let's see. In place of domination is participation. In place of control is liberation. In place of achievement, I would put love. They don't seem like opposites, but there's some real sense in which they're complementary. Humans above nature, humans in nature. An emphasis on efficiency and uniformity. An emphasis over here on adaptability and diversity. An emphasis on over on one side of redoubled effort. If something doesn't work, you redouble the effort. Over here is an emphasis on alternatives. Reuben Nelson, a Canadian futurist, said, if you don't succeed, the old adage is, if at first you don't succeed, try again, right? If at first you don't succeed, sit on your butt and think about who you are and where you are, for you may be deeply confused, and your environment may be trying to tell you something. Don't try harder, but think and see afresh. Try new images. And that's part of what the new paradigm is doing, saying maybe the reason we're not getting to where we think we should have gotten by this time is that we're not even doing the right thing at all. And so trying harder is going to be doing worse, so saying more of the wrong thing. So if you can agree, though, on your ends, or if the ends are taken for granted, then, of course, the challenge is production, efficiency, product. Know-how, doing things in the best possible way. Whereas over here, you're constantly questioning the process and the challenging the assumptions. Competition, synergy, self, community, personal sins, systemic evil, codified truth and doctrine over here, mythological truth, storytelling over here, theology of glory over here, theology of the cross over here. It's important to notice that the openness that I've talked about is always reciprocal. It's always mutual. It's always interactive. All processes of nature are interactive, not one way. And the that has an effect, for example, on our notions of missionary work. To be a missionary is not to bring the truth to the heathen. To be a missionary is to enter into a process with someone else who sees the world differently from you. And that process can change you, transform you. In fact, you should expect that change. And you should, you're vulnerable, you're under risk when you confront another point of view. Or if you're not, you're just being dogmatic and you're missing the interactiveness that's potentially there. Jesus, one of the famous things that he came for was to open eyes and ears, was to cure the blind and the deaf. And that's, you know, been often pointed out, but that's not just a literal interpretation. All of it is certainly a literal interpretation, that he was definitely making the blind see and the ears open, the deaf hear. But it's also a metaphorical interpretation, that the openness was important to Jesus too. The openness of ears, openness of eyes, is just a really fundamental Christian concept. For Christians, some of the implications of this paradigm, to me, are a greater awareness that God is acting in the world to redeem the entire creation, not just the souls of a few of his chosen people, but God is throughout in a process of redeeming all things. Our health, our wholeness, our redemption, our shalom is not independent from that of the entire human family, all of God's children. And so waging peace becomes a central priority as part of establishing a more cooperative, less self-righteous attitude toward the rest of the world, including nature. Waging peace becomes a lifestyle of greater simplicity, of growing concern for the environment, for more responsible resource caretaking, for world hunger, for economic justice, for minority rights, for human rights. Because all these areas are interconnected and require not just incremental change, but systemic change, transformation. A holistic paradigm calls attention to the one-sided incompleteness of a world dominated by traits traditionally associated with so-called masculine aspects of human nature. Obsession with power, control, dominance, conquest, competitiveness, proving oneself, individualism, pride, judgment, all apparent in war, they're apparent in the thrust and the character of our technologies, apparent in the exploitation of nature and of women and children, of the poor, and apparent in the triumphal rhetoric of our leaders. The traditionally feminine aspects of human nature, nurturing and caring and cooperativeness and receptiveness and openness and humility, compassion, which one would curiously note that all those qualities we use to describe Jesus, are clearly due for an emergence to balance and to heal and make whole the excessive masculinity of today's world. One caveat, though, one warning I feel, that the most of the writing in this area has been done by humanists. I like humanists. I guess I am one to a large extent. But there's one place where I feel like they need a critique coming from Christianity and from a strong theological base. And that is that they have an optimism that's not just optimism, but it's almost a naive failure to recognize the power and depths of evil in the world. And it comes back to the sermon that that Scott gave the other night, I think. Know the enemy, love the enemy, recognize exactly how real the evil is.
And so the nurse is the deification of evil.
Right, right. And the danger of that. That, to me, affiliates very closely with the theology of glory. It's saying, in effect, that we humans, all we have to do is get our act together, work together, bring harmony and love and peace and justice all around the world, everything's going to be beautiful. And it's not acknowledging the cross. It's not acknowledging the suffering that's necessary. It's not acknowledging the sacrifice that's necessary, the pain, and the reliance upon God, that there is something other than just ourselves. And for me, I guess that's some more radical hope. It's just a simple hope that everybody's going to turn good. It's that something even bigger than that is going on, and we need to have that larger perspective. Finally, the church, I think, can enter into the spirit of this change process by challenging its members to critically examine their own worldviews with their eyes and ears open to the world and in light of God's love and redemptive activity in the world. Recognize that, I mean, it's a constant process. Daily, recognizing that I may not have all the answers, and I've got to be open. And open, trying to see where God's at work in the world. The church can provide a supportive community in which the sometimes painful process of change can take place. And without that community, I'm lost. I don't have the personal internal strength to deal with change as it seems to be asked of me. And I need the support of that community. And the church has to see itself in that role of giving people the support, the lifting, the carrying that they need when they're going through processes of changing their way of dealing with the world. And then encouraging members both individually and corporately to risk working for peace and justice, participating with God in the redemption of ourselves and our institutions and our world and all of creation. God bless you all.
I get your final comment about the theology of the cross being a critique also of this. Something that I was thinking about this whole time we've been talking. Because I kept thinking, well, it sounds like a lot of these people are sort of seeing that not only are these things happening, but that there's an inevitability to it. Mm-hmm. And I guess as a Christian, I know that there's still a lot of struggle to come. Mm-hmm. And most afternoons when I'm going out on my calls, I listen to a Christian talk show in Portland that is pretty fundamentalist, but I just sort of like to know what the other side is doing, in a way. And it's amazing how they see the New Age and the holism and that Penelope of movements you talked about as a conspiracy, as a demonic thing, as a one world government, as a sign of the Antichrist, and so on and so forth. And there's a whole group of people out there that are see it as a completely other thing. And I look at that.
And it's all working against God, right? Against the order that God has brought.
I look at that, and I look at what's happening in our government today, in a kind of the yuppiness and the conservative pulling back from social progress and the concern about making money. And I look at the nationalistic movements in the world and the forces of separation and of division that go on, and I see that it by no means is a settled thing yet. Mm-hmm. That there's still a lot of struggle and a lot of process to come. Mm-hmm. So I really am glad that you came up at the end there and talked about the fact that heaven on earth is a long ways to come.
There's no necessary resurrection. That's a gift if it comes. Our guarantee of success is not at all obvious. It's on faith That's what Paul says anyway. For obvious, everybody would believe, I guess, but it's not.
Or you don't get the end of Revelation without the middle.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's real easy to, for me and or for us to build up a worldview in which we all basically agree and here at Holden, it's easy to do, where we all sort of have a general kind of outlook on life and we feel like, gee, this is what's really happening, you know? Mm-hmm. Or you get with another group of people and boy, they have a whole other outlook altogether.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
This is our viewpoint, but it still ain't the majority.
And that's true.
It's going to be a long time.
I'm coming to believe that, my idea is about different kinds of futures, is most people that are writing in this area see that sort of the old order is kind of coming down, this new order is going to be emerging. I don't think it's going to be like that. I think there's going to be a parallelism for a long time, maybe forever, I don't know, but that you're going to, in effect, have to choose which world you're going to look at.
Maybe it's always see. Been there, that parallelism.
I suppose. Which world are you going to live in? Where are you going to put your energies? What are you going to pay attention to? But this other world isn't going to just die and fade away.
I think the view of this, these kind of tensions, what you had said earlier, was that the, quote, the old and the new, there's a sort of overlay, they overlap each other, and the need is for a dialogue within that particular frame.
Good, yeah.
Because I think so much those who are on the one side or the other tend to, like the fundamentalists that you're listening to, they condemn, quote, the new, and a lot of the folks who are on the, quote, the new side are ready to condemn it throughout the old.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in either direction you're facing a conflict which is very destructive,
mm-hmm.
rather than to engage in a dialogue and a conversation which will bring understanding to both. Because I think so there's a sort of fascination with a kind of new point of view, whether it's a liberation theology or a feminism or whatever it might be, new economics, which suggests that everything else that has ever been said before down the area is totally wrong, evil,
right.
And
right.
It must be destroyed totally and obliterated.
Right.
And you just can't do that and keep the peace, you know, which is really our concern, to keep the peace in the world. The peace will come only as at least in the one area, fundamentalists and liberals and theology can start talking to each other. Mm-hmm. We don't.
Don't you hear what you're saying as a part of the new paradigm? Just the way that you said it,
mm-hmm.
is an expression of the new paradigm, because the old paradigm would create a dichotomy, which isn't there in the new paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
Paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
That the old way of thinking is to decide where the dichotomy is, and what you're saying is not to decide where the dichotomy is, but to decide where the relationship is.
That was good. I think on the other hand, you quote the old, even sense of dogmatics, I think too often we simplify that, assume and suggest and insist that those who have, let's say, take the area of dogmatics, which I'm familiar with, that they were totally closed, which is not true.
Okay.
No. Like, dogmaticians, for example, of there's some kind, but I think a lot of dogmatics is not that closed. Even 100 years ago, it was much more open.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the need is really for a dialogue. And then take the political realm, I think the current political, at least in America, administration or Germany or in England, is a kind of a last gasp of an attempt to restore, to go back to a particular system which seemed to make everybody happy, which is not true, I think, but this is, at least from my point of view, this is kind of the last gasp. But I think there has to be some sort of dialogue there. I think the reason we're not talking at Geneva or anywhere else is because you have a very closed system, a very narrow mind. I think the Republicans, just to use them as a group, have not always been as narrow minded as the current administration. I think there have been some very intelligent Republicans in the past. And but I think currently we have a symbolical person, who the president, who represents Fort Mitzman, so the last chance to hold it all together the way it's been, the way it's advantageous to the few. But it's not going to last. But there's no dialogue possible with that.
Right.
You can see the kind of rhetoric you have between the president and the Congress, or the president and the or the administration and Russia, or administration and Central America. It's always a very clear-cut, sharp, and evil.
So Davy Crockett, motto, be sure you're right, then go ahead.
That's right.
And he's sure he's right, and go on ahead. How can you dialogue with that?
Of course, the danger of all this is that while we're waiting for that last gasp to consume itself, we might all be consumed in that final gasp.
True.
I was trying at one point, I agree with you completely, I was trying to write a paper called something about a meta-paradigm. I mean, you've got a paradigm, you've got a paradigm, how are they going to coexist without a meta-paradigm to kind of gate, bridge them and allow the communication? And I realized, sort of like you were saying, that what has to be the qualities of the meta-paradigm to allow these to peacefully coexist? And it has to be openness, tolerance, diversity, a willingness to allow ambiguity and reduction of threat and coercion, and sort of a willingness not to kill for the sake of your particular truth. That seems to be really fundamental. And yet, that isn't held by this paradigm. Well, not all people.
Well, you've got the black hat, white hat approach. So you've got the gunslinger approach.
But on the other hand, you may also be describing the yin and the yang. That in fact, some of the answers that we're looking for are in that image of the yin and the yang. Those Eastern teachings about, you know, the out of balance-ness of one side over the other side. Mm-hmm. You know, so the, you know, the, is it a mandala, is that what you call it? The yin and the yang is it's often represented, you know, as a sort of two teardrops, one red, one white, and one black, in a sphere, in a circle. But the image is more of a emotion, you know, things that are in motion as opposed to just flat, two-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
There is emotion, a spinning around of those two opposite energies that you're not going to just throw out the old paradigm. In other words, you're not going, you know, because it's almost as though where we've been is sort of on the fat side of the yang, you know, sort of just really lots of yang and very little, you know, if this is what we've been experiencing here, if this is where we are now, and you're saying the movement is here, where this is a sphere that's always going round and round, but, you know, it's sort of like this is where we've been for 3,000 years, and we're moving, you know, to another place, but then we know that there will be a point at which we'll move back, because it'll always be spinning. It might be a meta paradigm for what's happening. It might be a modern discovery of ancient wisdom.
And then there are the two little circles within the fat part.
Absolutely.
Where they contain each other.
Right. Where this never totally disappears. Very quiet.
Hi, Alex. You want to be in class with us? We've been learning.
But you have to take Christ as the redeeming force, I think it has to be considered. I think that our redemption is...
It's like in my home church, when you get into a conversation that gets into anything at all interesting, you know, beyond the weather and stuff, and you want to talk about politics or something, you realize that I really very much had this paradigm, different living in different worlds kind of feeling of, you know, we can talk a little bit, but you know that the trouble is, the reason we're not communicating very well is that there's just all this foundation that's different, but our perspectives from way, way back are different. And what you need is, you know, at least a weekend together and more, be able to sit down and really get at why it is that we're coming out of different ends on the political scheme. That their idea of God is different from mine, their idea of the use of the Bible is different from mine, their idea of where the world's going is different from mine. Just a whole set of assumptions and priorities and values that they live in a different place. It's not just a matter of, oh, we're all in agreement on everything except practice. No, we're not, unfortunately.
I think I don't know what you mean, but I think I heard you say something about that when we try to look at ancient religions. there are people who want to sort of bring all that in and say that's Christian. I think, yeah, you know, there's a place where it isn't.
But on the other hand, I want to say, I still believe that God is alive and well in India, for example. God's activity through the other, God is active through the other religions.
Well,
it's not to say that Christianity doesn't have something very special and very unique, but I think God is active through other religions.
Well, God's active everywhere.